The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on Mockingjay Part 1, the third movie in the four-part Hunger Games series. And joining me to talk about it is Slate's TV critic, Willa Paskin. Hey, Willa.
Hey.
Have we ever spoiled a movie together before? I can't remember.
Way before I even worked here. I think we maybe spoiled It's Complicated with Meryl Streep and Alec Baldwin.
Which, as I remember, I completely loved with no real defense for why.
Oh, it's lovable.
It's completely charming. But it's very nice to be spoiling with you again. And I feel like I have to mention that we are the inaugural podcasters to be creating our work from this, I don't know what to call it, the new Slate cast box. This
dark, like the black box theater.
Yeah, completely. It's like the arty new little zone that's been constructed in the Slate office for the second podcast of the day being made at one time, because Slate podcasts have now spiraled into such cosmic proportions. We have so many of them that we can't all use our main studio at the same time. So it's kind of cool to be in this dark foam room with you. And breaking it in.
We should be talking in hushed voices, maybe.
Not too hushed. We gotta make ourselves heard. So, Mockingjay. This is the third movie in a four-part series from three books. So, I've wanted to start off by talking about what Dan Coy's editor at Slate called penultification. This phenomenon of taking the last book in a series, a popular beloved series that's being adapted into film, and dividing into two parts. Harry Potter did it. Who else has done it?
Twilight did it.
And I guess you could say Peter Jackson is doing it with The Hobbit,
but
to an extreme degree,
yeah,
right? Dividing a small 100-something page book into three-hour movies. That is going down a whole other road. But I wanted to talk about this more mainstream process of chopping a book in half before we begin, because it sort of dooms this second to last movie in any series to being a setup movie. It has to be a placeholder. It can't satisfyingly resolve because it has to leave you coming back for more.
And also because none of these books are overstuffed. It's not like they're like, oh, we had so much material, we had to break them in half.
Harry Potter, arguably, is a gigantic book.
But it's like completely this financial decision, basically. So especially in something like for Mockingjay, where sort of the first half of the book is really a lot of setup, and there's a very clear second half that's very obviously cinematic and like an action sequence.
Sort of all hell breaking loose, right? Because we should start out by saying, if you haven't read the Hunger Games book, that the last book, and this isn't giving too much away, is all about war. I mean, the conflict that's been set up over the course of the first two books and this dystopian society that's starting to have a rising rebel movement finally all explodes and turns into this giant civil war in the last book. So that's what we're getting set up for here.
Right. And the setup for that is just a lot of sort of everyone positioning themselves. I mean, they had to make up an entire action sequence to sort of climax this film. Like the whole
explosion of the dam sequence?
The explosion of the dam and then the whole rescuing of Peeta, where sort of Katniss is watching and we're getting everybody else, and the whole Finnick talking to Snow thing. That's all fabricated and over. I mean, they did rescue Peeta, but in the book, it's just like, it's happening while she's not there. She's worried about it. And then they're back.
You mean turning it into a suspense sequence?
Yeah, because they kind of needed like a final brouhaha.
Right. And so to the degree that there's a problem to be solved in this penultimate chapter of the Hunger Games series, it's the problem of getting Peeta out of captivity, right?
Right.
And who he may have been brainwashed while he's in captivity.
He definitely was brainwashed.
Right.
Tracker venom.
That's right. And what else is the big conflict here? And essentially,
getting Katniss on board with like being the Mockingjay.
Right.
Like
turning Katniss into the face of the revolution,
right,
essentially.
And having her and figuring out how to do that in an effective way.
Something that I felt was that the ball was sort of dropped on thematically is, which I guess could be picked up next time, is the idea that what's happening to Katniss is just a copy of what happened to her before, right? I mean, the idea that she is now part of these liberatory forces that are going to change society is somewhat undercut by the fact that she's being used as part of the propaganda arm of the rebellion, the same way that she was used for the Hunger Games.
Well, I mean, there is this whole tension in the whole movie about her concerns being small and human scale and related to the people that she loves, to Peeta, to Prim, to her mother, to Gale, at the expense sometimes, or not even at the expense, but in sort of just in terms of her weighing it against the good of the people. Like, she's not there with that yet. She still is really invested in her immediate loved ones. You know, no one actually makes the case to her that way. Like, you have this bigger – I mean, they say she has a bigger part to play. But then she's like, I'll only do it if you forgive Peeta. You know, like, she's really still her heart is still in this micro
right.
place.
She's not Joan of Arc. She's being posed as Joan of Arc and sort of turned into her in these propos, as they call them, propaganda videos. But she really is more of a – she's more like Britney Spears or something. I mean, she's kind of a created sensation, right? She's a manufactured sensation.
So, and then she's a manufactured sensation, but then just in her inner life, it's something much more like individualistic than – you know, it's not brain damaged like Britney Spears. That might be kind of like rude, but you know, but her incentives are still very concrete and based around her experience and not about ideology.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about Jennifer Lawrence, too, before we get into this, because I would argue that at this point, it's essentially just Jennifer Lawrence's charisma that's carrying the series. I think I liked this episode less than you did. And what made it continue to be watchable and somewhat fun for me and made me at least want to come back for the next one is that Jennifer Lawrence has just become such a movie star that it's fun to just sort of watch her be.
Well, it's funny because I think I probably did like it more than you did, but I thought her performance was maybe worse than you did. Like, I like watching her. I thought she did a good enough job to make me want to watch her. But I thought there was so much sort of like tremble, cry emoting. I mean, it's sort of what she has to do that it almost sort of bordered on. For me, there was a couple moments that kind of bordered on the full on, like almost accidentally campy, like the sobbing. I can't lose both of them. Like, you know, these close ups on her face. Where
whose arms is she sobbing in? Hamish?
I think it must be Hamish, you know, and we're just like, OK, this is a lot. Oh, you know, and then also
I can't lose both of them. That bring us to our triangle conversation for later. But I can't lose both of them to be like one of the dudes hearing that. Like, oh, great. I'm glad I'm half of the party of people that you cannot bear
totally.
To lose.
And then just also, I you know, there's this funny thing. There have been a couple movies lately, Birdman, The Comeback, which isn't a movie but on HBO, where you have these actors having to play bad or good actors. Like, they have to signal, like, this is me doing something that's bad or this is me doing something that's good. And it's really an impressive feat when they pull it off. Like, I think Lisa Kudrow in The Comeback, you're like, whoa, you are doing a really good job seeming, like, really good. I thought one of the problems with Birdman was that Michael Keaton, it wasn't always clear if he was doing good. But the thing about this with Jennifer Lawrence is, like, when she's supposed to be acting badly in the propos, like, she did a good job acting badly. But then when she was supposed to be acting better in the sort of more authentic off-the-cuff ones, I was like, these don't seem different enough to me. Like, this still seems pretty stiff and, like, not great.
But that might also be a function of the fact that, I mean, ultimately what she's being asked to do is extremely artificial and sort of not very inspiring. I mean, the idea that these are things that inspired a nation seem kind of crazy because the propos that are put together by the Julianne Moore character and the Philip Seymour Hoffman character, the leaders of this revolutionary movement, they have this very manufactured, you know, it's get out the vote on MTV kind of feeling.
Totally. Even the ones that are supposed to be like genuinely rousing or she's genuinely moved and horrified by what the Capitol is doing, that they've bombed this hospital and they're going to come for you, or, you know, that they've done what they've done to District 12, you know, or her singing, you know. I think it must be just very hard to go from this register of this character that's basically like locks everything down to someone who is supposed to have these moments where she's suddenly opens up. And that might be totally realistic, that when that person opens up, they still seem a little.
Right. I mean, maybe the books by their nature can do that better because we can get Katniss's interior monologue and her conflicts about it.
And also, as Miriam Krull, who's a copy editor here, pointed out, in the books, like, the things that are going on in her interior monologue in this movie are insane and all over the place. Like, she's just running like a crazy, jagged mountainscape of feeling and having these epiphanies that I think there are quote-unquote epiphanies where, like, when you're reading, you're like, oh, is this actually a huge insight? Like, you realize they're using PETA. In the movie, this happens too, where she's like, I realize they're using PETA to get to me. And you're just sort of like, is that an epiphany?
Like, like, it hasn't been happening in every prior chapter.
Yeah, you're just like, that seems like what's happening, you know?
Yeah, well, in terms of J-Law's performance, just to wrap it up, I mean, I this is obviously not the most challenging role that she'll ever have, and particularly in this chapter. You know, she had so much great action in the earlier versions. When they were inside the biodome, you know, so actually fighting the Hunger Games, she had all kinds of individual moment-by-moment problems to solve. And here, really, again and again, she's forced to sort of confront suffering and react to it. You know, she's really passive.
That is a really hard – that's actually really hard. Like, it is really challenging. I think this is a really challenging role, even though – it's like sort of superficial in some ways. Like that is really hard to do.
Yeah, something that I said at the end of my review, I sort of feel like, I mean, Philip Seymour Hoffman, who we're seeing here for the penultimate time, actually, he'll be in the second Mockingjay movie, too, but presumably will have a curtailed role because he died during the shooting of that one. But I was saying that, you know, in a way, Jennifer Lawrence sort of feels like she's starting to work her way toward becoming that kind of actor that he is, who just because he put himself his all into everything, you know, there was sort of no such thing as a bad role. There was no such thing as a minor character that he was just blowing his way through for the paycheck. And I think she's feeling that way, too. And it makes you very sympathetic toward her.
Yeah, totally. She really has it, you know.
All right. So granting that Jennifer Lawrence has it, stipulating, do you want to just do a brief walkthrough of the story of this movie, such as it is? It shouldn't take long because this is a setup movie and not a whole lot happens.
Yeah, let's do it. So essentially, at the end of Catching Fire, Katniss inadvertently explodes the Hunger Games and is extracted by the rebels in District 13. And PETA is not. And she and Finnick are taken to District 13.
Finnick being another of the young tributes, right? Another of the Hunger Games players.
Are taken to District 13 where they were bombed very, very heavily by the Capitol in the distant past. There's no life on the surface, but they have sort of siloed down into these bunkers, and they have this operating militaristic defense society that is getting its forces ready to kind of wage war on the Capitol.
Right, with Julianne Moore playing Al McCoyne, the leader, and Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Plutarch Heavensby, who we previously thought was a Capitol flunky, but who is now either defected to the rebel side or was he just a double agent the whole time?
I think he was a double agent. And Beatty is also – the Jeffrey Wright character, Beatty, is also there. He was also extracted. So over the course of this – episode over the course of this movie, of this installment of
this half movie, we might say.
Basically, the District 13, the leadership of District 13, needs to convince Katniss to become the sort of figurehead of the revolution, and then to film all these propos, which are propaganda ads, to sort of disseminate to the districts to sort of foment revolution. And basically, the movie is sort of her going from them figuring out that she needs to be sort of doing live action to seem compelling and going visiting sort of sites of atrocities to film these propos.
Being followed by this uber hip video team that completely cracked me up. These like very young videographers.
Totally, who have a sense of fashion. The only people who have any fashion in all of District 13 except for Effie. Trinket.
Yeah, worth noting too, because this series has so been about costume design and clothes and the incredible fashions of the Capitol that basically everyone is wearing olive drab jumpsuits the entire time.
Totally. So then, and then basically, and simultaneously, Katniss is extremely tortured because it's very clear that PETA, who is being used by the Capitol as sort of their counter to her revolutionary fervor, is being tortured. And sort of at the end of the film, they rescue him. And it turns out that he's been brainwashed. And there's a couple of really horrible scenes of him. She goes to see him because she hasn't seen him for, you know, weeks and is distraught. And he just strangles her and really strangles her. I mean, that scene was really horrible. I mean, I thought impressively horrible.
Yeah, I mean, this is something just to touch on later when we talk about the ending and looking forward to the next chapter. But this series is getting more and more brutal. I mean, I would have taken maybe an 11-year-old kid or something to the first two chapters. I would not take a child to this unless they were pretty sophisticated in their viewing and able to withstand like a lot of not just physical violence, but like visions of mass brutality and kind of state terror.
I mean, District 12 has been turned into a killing field. There's like shots of cremated skeletons, like thousands of them.
Yeah, there's shots that kind of evoke the Holocaust with piles of skeletons, and there's point blank executions with people with bags over their heads. I mean, it really looks like, you know, there's moments where you feel like you're in either Dachau or Guantanamo.
Yeah.
And then we end on this image that I thought the ending was really a strange place to chop off the book. But you've read Mockingjay, reread it more recently than me. So tell me what you thought about the ending and what the ending is.
So the very end of the film is they've sort of successfully rescued PETA and Joanna and Anna, who's Finnick's love interest. They've gone into the Capitol. They've come out alive. It seems that with the Capitol's implicit permission to leave. And PETA's been...
Right, the Capitol let them go.
Because PETA's sort of been weaponized, essentially. And Al McCoyne, we hear, giving a speech, the president giving a speech to everyone in District 13 about how they've sort of – they rescued these tributes and they're sort of making progress. And it's cut with footage of Katniss walking
– getting out of her hospital bed, right?
Right, getting out of her hospital bed, this, you know, walking towards sort of like this very bright fluorescent light behind glass. you know, we keep cutting back and forth. And then she see we come to the the window of the room, and you see PETA chained to the bed, you know, or handcuffed to the bed with soft restraints, just screaming
like a rabid dog,
just thrashing around. You can't hear him, but just, you know, possessed out of his mind.
Must kill Katniss.
You know, really, really horrible. Her face, like, cut to the end of the movie, and just really bleak. I mean, bleak, 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 bleak.
Where would you have chopped the book? Would you have put it there?
I unfortunately, maybe this, I may be biased because I thought about this too much, like, going in. I think they basically had to end the movie there. I thought they could have ended it on him choking her.
That's what I thought, too.
Which maybe would have been almost too cliffhangery in a way. Like, I could imagine if it ended at that moment of the scene of
him
choking.
But you get no new information from him
crashing
in the bed.
It's just, but it's just like, it would have just been so abrupt. Because there's that way that with these movies, you just are like, when they do the real just cliffhanger, you feel so, doesn't it make you feel so cheap? It makes me feel so cheap sometimes when it's like the movie's like, gotcha, come back for more late. Like, I almost want the 5-minute beat just so I can like calm down and be like, okay, I can see how I can live without you for a year.
But it's a very, very disturbing image to end a movie on. Maybe even more disturbing than the contact between them, because at least that's their encounter.
Yeah.
But something about him, like, isolated in restraints and just foaming at the mouth was a horrifying.
But that's why I thought
end.
It was great. I mean, knowing also what comes next, I didn't think they had much of a choice. Like, basically, the next book is about one sort of sustained military action. I mean, there'll be another military. There's a smaller military action and then a huge one. I knew that that had to be the last book. So I was expecting it to end around here. And I do just think, I think there's just something about, there just seems like there's some chutzpah to this franchise in a way that I really respect, which is like, it's like, I know this is kind of this YA book and it stars Jennifer Lawrence and they're hugely successful and it's going to be really, really, really messed up. Like, messed up beyond our, what we could get away with being so much less messed up and it's still seeming like pretty dark.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and in that sense, I think it's pretty faithful to the books. I mean, it reminds me a bit of the Harry Potter movies in that way. I don't think any of the Hunger Games movies have quite touched me as much as the Harry Potters,
yeah.
But maybe that's just my preference for that franchise. But it's similar in the sense that it is sort of for fans only. It's pretty faithful to the books, including in tone, and there's not really a sense of pandering or glossing over or trying to bring in new people who didn't like the Hunger Games already.
Right.
That leaves you a huge audience, right?
Who are those people?
Okay, so we were just, before we started taping, you mentioned briefly, and I want you to elaborate on it, that the Twilight love triangle and the Hunger Games love triangle are not really comparable, even though both of them are sort of about, you know, this girl taking forever to decide between two inexplicably devoted guys who never seem to just say, fuck this, and walk off.
Totally. Well, so Twilight is a love triangle. Like, that is what it is. There's a vampire and there's a werewolf, but, like, the actual narrative engine of that whole series is Bella's love affair with Edward. Hunger Games, you know, it could very easily exist in certain ways without Katniss being in love with either of those guys. It's like this horrible dystopic like world that's descending into civil war that the romance is almost like an escape valve for. And it's not even central to Katniss's understanding of herself. Like, she doesn't, you know, she like loves Gale, but maybe not as much as she should or he wants her to. She doesn't love PETA as much as he wants him to. I mean, they're just, she's very genuinely conflicted. It's not the heart, I don't think, in a way of what's happening, of the action, certainly. And maybe just even, it's not even like, she's really the focal point and not her relationships of this series. So obviously it sort of, the triangle, like, for marketing reasons, for just sort of like fun reasons, fits into this love triangle scheme that has been around not just from Twilight but from Everything Forever, and you kind of want to play like Team Gale and Team PETA. But there's a way that the boys are really, I think, ancillary to just Katniss in these movies, and even as we watch them thinking so much about who she's going to end up with, it sort of like isn't the point, basically.
Yeah, I guess that is certainly true, because Twilight so obsessively returns to that question. But there's something to me about, yes, the love triangle, yes, it's an ancient, you know, model in romantic dramas and going back before that. But this particular kind of teen love triangle where the woman is the protagonist and she's choosing between these two men that are just sort of sitting there waiting on silver platters indefinitely, I'm fascinated by that and the appeal of it to teen girls. And wondering also, was there anything like that when we were teen girls? Is there something about now that we want that story? I just wonder why that's a story that there's such a hunger for.
I mean, that sort of speaks to the way that Katniss also, like, is just really awesome. as a sort of heroine, as a sort of fictitious heroine. I mean, Manola Dargis in the Times is like obsessed with Katniss as this really like different kind of superhero.
Did she like this movie?
She did. And she's written every time she writes about Hunger Games, and she's right. And all the anytime she's sort of writing a cultural essay, you could just tell she like.
So as soon as Hunger Games comes up on the Times, whatever it is, the
she's
schedule,
like, I
she's
got
grabbing
this one.
It.
Yeah. And like, because I think she thinks Katniss is really unique. And Katniss is really unique because, I mean, I think this was pointed out by someone here last time around. Like, PETA is so in the quote unquote girl part, right? Like, he's adoring no matter what.
He bakes cupcakes.
He's the nurturer. He's the one who can talk. He's the one who listens. He, you know, and Katniss is sort of the fickle male who just is deciding if she maybe likes this other side piece who's cuter or better. I mean, I do think one of the things that's also problematic for me about the love triangle in the movies is I just, and this is so shallow but so real, I find Josh Hutcherson and Liam Hemsworth so unevenly cast just in like sex appeal that it weights this thing. I mean, the triangle is weighted towards PETA, but it weights it back towards Gale in this way you almost just wish it wouldn't. Like, Josh Hutcherson is just not strapping enough for there to be, like, for it to feel kind of as love triangle-y.
Yeah,
it was
a strange choice because he already is the more frail character, right? But he's so unrugged, the guy that they cast. Like, if you see pictures of them on a red carpet,
he's a tiny man.
I mean, nothing against Josh Hutcherson, but he is a tiny little man. Right. And in this episode in particular, the tiny little man is held prisoner the entire time and is, you know, has been brainwashed and has no control even over the words that he's uttering on TV to Stanley Tucci. Yeah. And so there really is a sense that he's kind of a cipher. And so I sort of felt that her, you know, incredible drive to rescue him and her guilt toward him, even when he starts to turn against her and turn against the revolution and say these things on TV that make it seem like he's gone over to the dark side, it almost seemed more like a pity, you know.
No, totally.
Out of pity.
And in a weird way, that's almost like, it's possible to think that's actually what it is. I have a friend who's really team Gale, and she basically is like, this is a conversation between like sex and romance and sort of like companionate settling because you basically have horrible PTSD. The first being Gale and the second being PETA. And obviously, when you put it that way, then how could you not be team Gale? But the thing I
But isn't Liam Hemsworth also so incredibly charismaless?
I mean,
he's a hunk, but he's literally a hunk. He's like a hunk of flesh.
Right, totally. But, I thought that dichotomy between like sex and settling was like is not really what's there. But when you actually just with the casting a little bit, it sort of makes that come to life a little more than I would want it to. And so then it sort of complicates this love triangle's whole way, which is like, oh, maybe this, you know, she's so damaged that these things, the things that are important to us watching love triangles aren't important to her because she needs to be safe. And PETA, who is this sort of relatively wimpy, very sweet and adoring man, is like the safe choice, which she actually needs because she's when this thing is going to be over because of just how horrible it's been.
So having talked about Jennifer Lawrence a bit, is there anyone else whose performance you want to note or somebody whose casting you think is particularly right or wrong? Like, what do you think of the cast that's been put
together? I actually thought Elizabeth Banks was really continues to be pretty delightful. And this kind of she had like a different note to play than she has. She's Effie Trinket, who's the sort of the wardrobe stylist, inane consultant for PETA and Katniss. And she's been this kind of ridiculous capital figure who is always trying to boss them around, and Katniss sort of bridles against her, but has shown up in District 13. It's been reduced to, you know, wearing and she has none of her wigs.
She manages to style her jumpsuit, though, interestingly.
Yeah.
She's
amazingly.
Got, like, fingerless gloves and sunglasses and stuff. So she still manages to have this kind of decadent movie star feeling, like she's sitting by a pool,
totally.
Sipping a martini.
And she
bunker.
Was, like, she's, like, the only real note of comedy, kind of, in the whole.
And she gets to play some real comedy here because she's sort of boo-hooing about the lack of accoutrements. But it was the idea that she defected willingly from the Capitol.
I think they might have just taken her. I don't think she. Also, I think that this was taken out of the film, but in my recollection is that she, and I think there's actually a couple other of Katniss's sort of fashion people have also ended up in District 13, and Katniss stumbles upon them like living kind of in imprisoned, like maybe living in their own urine and rags kind of situation, and then sort of freeze, like gets them to help her, like helps them in their situation in District 13, that it's not quite as pleasant as it seemed in this film.
And then I think the other performance to note, and maybe this, again, is just my sadness and how much I'm going to miss seeing him on screens, but Philip Seymour Hoffman as Plutarch Heavensby really brings something, too. I mean, his lines on paper are pretty standard. He essentially sort of sits around at these strategy meetings advising Katniss on what she has to do to become the face of the revolution. But there's something about the way he plays it. I love that he's often got this sort of wry smile as she's misbehaving and not doing anything that they want her to do, that there's this sense that he respects her, you know, that he understands that the very rebellious spirit that's making her so unmanageable and so difficult to negotiate with is what's going to make her be able to be the face of the revolution.
Obviously, his death, like, colors the way that I saw that performance. I thought that the movie is dedicated to him, and it's actually very sweet that it's dedicated to him. You know, he didn't have very much to do.
Yeah, he's sitting around at tables like everybody else is. Right. But I always had my eye on him in those group scenes just to kind of see his almost sort of affectionate disgust at her and her difficulty to work with.
Totally.
And then the other thing I wanted to mention, just because it's something that I walked out humming, is the very haunting song, the little folk ballad that Jennifer Lawrence sings, that Katniss is asked to sing in one of the videos, and that becomes the rallying cry of the revolution. And during the one big action scene of the movie, which is the explosion of this dam at the Capitol, there's this whole group of people marching, singing this song that somehow they managed to write a song that really does sound to me like some ancient ballad.
The words are from the book, right? Like, it's a song her father taught her while she was hunting.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Like
the words per se are in the book, like those exact words.
I think the verses, like the hanging.
So that's
the tree.
Why, because I looked at the credits at the end and Suzanne Collins was credited. So I guess they just lifted the words and they found a really nice melody.
But they did
for
a really
them.
Good job.
And
they
Jennifer
did.
Lawrence can kind of sing, which made me wish she would do a musical or something. I mean, she's just carrying a simple tune, but she does it quite nicely.
Yeah, she did do it quite nicely. That was a really great scene, like a really evocative, moving sort of scene.
And somehow the idea of making it into that kind of traditional ballad, I don't know, it just gave a sort of history to the to the country. It made you feel that there's sort of a Panem, you know, song book that we never hear about, a traditional culture of Panem songs, and it made me wish I knew more of them.
Totally. I mean, it's actually interesting, you know, the three-note whistle, like the do-do-do, whatever it is.
The Mockingjay song.
The Mockingjay, you know, that also they've used so effectively. I mean, they use it in the trailers for the film, and then they used it in the propos. It, like, ends them, too. It's just a kind of cute touch. And I just think, like, that whistling, it's like a great music cue. It kind of makes me
I wish we had a musician in here to talk about this, but it sounds a lot like the Close Encounters of the Third Kind little four-note theme as well. And I wonder if there's something about those intervals that sort of, you know, like the haunting follow my lead, make a mashed potato mountain.
It's a good question.
Okay, well, is there anything else we want to cover looking forward to the next one before we wrap? Mockingjay Part 2. It's opening in November, 1 year from now. It's going to be super brutal.
I mean, so brutal. So brutal.
Are you going to be sad to see the series come to an end?
No, I mean it should end. I think also it's been really good. Like, I think the last movie, Catching Fire, was good. I liked this movie. I expect the finale to be good. I can't really imagine a better version.
Yeah, you're just glad it exists. Yeah, I would say I feel the same. All right, so Willa, in November 2015, when Mockingjay Part 2 comes out, will you come back to this black foam box with me and spoil it again?
Oh my God, my pleasure.
All right, it's a date. Our producer is Chris Wade. What do we call Joel, the managing producer? Our producer is Chris Wade. The managing producer of Slate Podcasts is Joel Meyer. And the executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Andy Bowers. I'm Dana Stevens for Slate.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.